What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Decade Project, the first for 2014 in 2024. Yes, this is a One Heat Minute Productions Patreon exclusive, at least for most of the year, podcast where I talk to an array of amazing guests and filmmakers about films that impacted us, the people that I'm talking to 10 years ago, but we go back and see if they're still resonating, if they're still having an impact. And I feel like, especially in the streaming age, if you're not a physical media lunatic like myself or some of my guests, including the one I'm talking to today, you know, you don't keep a library of stuff. You're kind of like a slave to whatever's in the carousel. And this movie particularly seems to have all the ingredients of something that should be carousel worthy, should be something that pops up, even shares something that I'll talk to you guys a little bit later in the episode that shares a lot in common with another gigantic movie from this year, but it feels like it really hasn't been spoken about since the time that it came out. So today I'm really lucky to talk to my friend who is an author and a noir scholar and watches more movies than really anyone on planet Earth that I know, is my dear friend Jedediah Ayres. Hello, Jed.
Hello.
Thank you for doing this. What movie are we talking about today?
We are talking about David Michaud's The Rover.
It's over for you.
I know that. Whatever you think's over for me was over a long time ago.
He's going south, long way from here. I'll take you to him, I promise.
Your brother left you to die. He's abandoned you out here to me. You don't learn to fight, your death's gonna come real soon. Stop thinking about a life you've taken. What's the price you pay for taking it?
I'm still in control here.
What's he doing?
He ain't giving up.
Start talking to me!
What a thing to get worked up about in this day and age.
No harm God won't see me come to.
God feels nothing for you. The only thing that means anything right now is that I'm here. And he's not.
Was that the question?
Yes, that is the question. David Michaud's The Rover. All right, so this movie came out in 2014. If you know nothing about it, basically there's a man with no name, essentially character played by Guy Pearce, is driving through a collapsed society in Australia, because it's after the collapse, as broad as that is, after the collapse and tantalizing. He's driving through the outback. His car gets stolen by a ragtag bunch of heisters, like a crew that is like done some kind of diabolical heist where it's all gone wrong. They steal his car and drive away, and he wants his car back. And until the end of the movie, you don't fully understand why the car has so much significance. All you know is that he's going after the car. One of the guys they leave behind is Robert Pattinson, who basically comes into this role and performance as the brother of one of the heisters who they leave behind because he was shot and they think that he's dead, but in fact he's alive, and he becomes like an unwitting sort of Stockholm Syndrome partner for this man with no name. And then they go on this journey together. And so it came out in 2014. It came out at Cannes Film Festival. It had an amazing response. There's even a quote from Quentin Tarantino that it's the best Australian post-apocalyptic movie since Mad Max. He was, you know, they didn't need any other pull quotes after that, Jed, just in case you needed to know. Mm-hmm. And it had a bit of a splash at Cannes. Like, it had a, you know, interesting response on the Decade Project. We talk about how it was responded to, but it kind of had on the one hand, these amazing, feverish, happy responses. And on the other hand, these extremely lukewarm responses that it was like a story about nothing. And it seemed like it had more pathos than it really did, and it didn't satisfy. So I want to go back to 2014 and ask, when did you see it? Was it 2014 cinema? Was it first time on DVD? When did you see it?
So I started my job working overnight in like the end of November, first week of December 2013.
Right.
So I was in a place in my life where I was doing overnight work, and I was going, you know, taking classes and things like that to learn about my new job and get it. You know, it was about a year and a half process before I was able to get registered and certified to do this work. And so this was like right at the beginning of that, and my mind is mush. You know, I hardly got out to see movies at all during that time. I mean, not only was it financially very difficult for me to go spend money at the movie theater, time was a whole other thing. You know, my kids were 10 years younger than they are now. My wife was working half the week. You know, I was working overnight, three nights a week, 13-hour shift, and then I was working another part-time job, you know, early in the morning on other days. And my wife and I were just trading back and forth, like, okay, it's your turn to have the kids. Okay, it's your turn to have the kids. And it's, you know,
you guys were just handing the baton of kids and all those other things. Yeah. Wow.
So no, I did not. I was very aware of this movie because I was absolutely obsessed with Animal Kingdom. And so I was so excited for new David Michaud. And so I was very excited for this movie, but I did not get to see it theatrically. But I did, you know, get it just as soon as it came out on DVD, rented it and watched it. And, you know, it does have a lot in common with Animal Kingdom, and there are some through lines now that Dave Michaud's got a larger body of work. You can kind of look at all of his stuff and say, okay, well, that's something he's interested in. He does it, you know. But
yes,
at the time, it was also different enough from the only exposure to him I had, which was, Animal Kingdom. I kind of had to sit with it for a while. Like, I knew it had hit me somehow, and I felt its power more than I felt its, like, I knew I'd been hit by something, but I didn't know
what it was,
what the effect was, you know?
Yeah.
It's like somebody who, it's like you walk out and you're that guy in the movie just, you know, with the tinnitus, you know, like something happened and I don't know. Am I shot? Am I, you know, I'm not sure what happened, but there was a big impact. And it's one that I've come back to over the years and watched it. Every time I watch it, you know, usually, I mean, this last several weeks, I've watched it multiple times, just kind of thinking about it, knowing we were going to talk about it. But, you know, until then, it had been every, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years, I'd watch it. And I'd go, oh, my God, how did I forget how great that was? You know, it's one that kind of strikes me differently every time I see it. And even in the last few weeks, watching it several times, I feel like, okay, this time I know what it's about. And it's like, no, I can't quite nail it down. And I really appreciate that about it, that it's, you know, the impact is still there. I still haven't pinpointed exactly what happened. And I don't mean what happened in the movie, but what happened, why is it affecting me, as much as it is. And I've got, you know, scattered thoughts about that. But honestly, I don't know that I could answer the question definitively. It is one that I find extremely affecting.
We're going to do our best to try. I was lucky enough at this time. This is kind of around the time that film criticism started to be a little bit less of a hobby and more of a vocation. I was writing for my blog at the time, Graffiti with Punctuation, and that was like our biggest year was 2014. And that year that The Rover came out, it came hot off of Cannes. And because David Michaud's a Australian filmmaker, it came to Sydney Film Festival, and it came with him and Guy Pearce and Robert Pattinson. And it was right at that frothy, crazy time. You know, they did like a Q&A in Sydney Town Hall, and it was just insane. I remember writing a very effusive review at the time of the film. And when I wrote about it, like, it had like an insane reaction, like way more than I was normally accustomed to. I'm like, why is this? Like, oh, it's because I said that Robert Pattinson was really excellent. And there's a whole Pattinson hive here, a la the Swifties, that just want to like hear that he was great in something that's not Twilight, you know, because I guess they were just craving it. And I genuinely think that this was the beginning for me of thinking of him as a really serious and seriously good actor, because at the time I was always like, I didn't know about him as a musician. I didn't know about him as a young actor. I didn't know about him as any of that crap. All I knew was from the Twilight movies. The first one was the one that I considered to be the best as far as like filmmaking, and the rest were just trash that I had no interest in. So for me, that was the case. But I was equally, like you, blown sideways by Animal Kingdom. Was so excited to get more David Michaud, and hearing the responses out of Cannes made me even more excited about it. But so at that time, though, you've got, like, I was going back and doing some research of some of the different reviews and reading some of the reviews, but just to give you some snapshots, you've got like a couple of really terrific film critics that's still working today, like, that I love. You know, I love Guy Lodge. I love Wesley Morris. Like, Guy Lodge was like, dour, inert vision of the future, a disappointing follow-up to the cracking Animal Kingdom. And Wesley Morris is like, it's a deadpan irony of the final sequence, seems like a punchline of a mournful but very thin joke. And you're like, oh, okay, guys, they did not resonate with it at all. And then you get people like Kenny Turin. I've just got to find where he was. Like, Ken Turin's like, a film shot in 100 degrees plus heat that chills the blood as well as the soul. And you're like, yeah, Kenny gets it. Like, or at least Kenny gets it in the way that I got it. So it is really strange, because overall it had a kind of mixed response at the time that it was released. But I think that its impact and its resonance is really the way that you can see it from kind of now. You can just see it in, like, that was a time that, like, a lot of people slept on the ability of Robert Pattinson. And then he just had this whole other fascinating post-Twilight career with, like, Cosmopolis and Good Time and you name it. There's some really fantastic movies in there where he just goes off the reservation. He's not doing anything conventional. I think that's really fun.
Yeah, and I mean, Michelle uses him again in The King. Really memorable little turn there. I mean, he's what a performer.
Oh, they're having a ball in The King. The King is delicious. Yeah.
I do think that, looking back, that Robert Pattinson was dominating what I was hearing about the film.
Yes.
People seem to think he was trying too hard to shed his Twilight image. And, I don't honestly remember what my reaction to him or my thoughts about him were. I don't think I'd seen Twilight. I knew the phenomenon a little, I knew it as a book. I was a bookseller, when those books were coming out. So I knew them as books. I don't think I'd seen the movies. So, I'd seen plenty of teen idols in my time kind of come the idea that somebody is more than just that very popular thing that they are first known for is, I feel like I was old enough to not have that be such a big revelation to me, but that was most of the conversation I remember hearing around the Rover was, the importance of it was whether or not Robert Pattinson succeeded in proving that he was something more than some people thought he was trying too hard and other people thought he was really a revelation. It's good, but
that was my impression. When I saw it at the time, I was like, he's a revelation. This guy's amazing. Yeah. He was so weird and wonderful and had such a tightrope because he hadn't, he's got this Southern drawly accent. He's playing the brother of Scoot McNairy, one of the greatest and most effortless character actors working. He's playing his brother, and he's his dim-witted brother. It got a lot in common actually with the sort of an inverse dynamic in Good Time of being the wily, savvy, criminal brother and having the dopey, Benny Safdie playing the sort of, the dim-witted brother out of those two. That's the role that he's got. And in this thing, in 2014, and look, we are going to spoil this. So I think that this is the kind of then and now. The other thing that I do is, and you can usually see it when 10-year anniversaries crest. And in this year, there's a couple of big 10-year anniversaries, one of them being an Interstellar or the Grand Budapest Hotel. There are these huge movies that are on the horizon in 2014 that are going to have a lot written about them. One of the movies that is going to have a lot written about it is John Wick. A movie about a guy whose dog is killed and he then murders 150 guys to get revenge for that cute puppy as a symbol of his relationship that has just been lost and the last sort of embers of a life that he lived in peace outside of this assassin's world. And what I think is so hilarious is that in the same year, only a few months later, is a movie where a guy and his dog being killed is the centerpiece of the story and becomes a phenomenon and has four sequels, and a movie about a guy going to get to bury his dog who lost his dog in the Rover seems to have slipped. I've tried to find articles written about it. I've found a couple of things that reference the Rover more directly in The King when people are talking about this is the second time that Robert Pattinson works with Michaud and da-da-da-da-da. So there's those references back, but there's not been a single piece of reappraisal or foundational stuff that that I can find on Google in the first 20 or 30 pages of Google. I know that some people don't even know that. Yes, when you do a search, you can go through multiple pages looking for things and keywords, but I have not found anything that people have talked about the Rover. And so it really strikes me as strange that in that same year with this same kind of elemental premise of this last little ember of life, maybe before the collapse, going away and doing anything you can to get that back so that you can feel like you have your humanity. It's not the one that hit. The one that hit was John Wick.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad you said elemental because that is a word that I've got written down, I don't know how many times in the last couple of weeks thinking about this movie, the elementalness of like, say, the violence.
Yes.
The treatment of that violence is just an element in, yes, in this world, that there are people who want to harness it and use it as a tool, but it's not. It's an element. It's the weather. It's the, you know, it you can respect it and yeah, you can fear it and you can try to avoid it, but you know, it's just something that comes in and devastates you, and it devastates you when it comes out of you, you know. Yes. The Rob Pattinson, when he shoots the innocent young girl, and Guy Pearce is someone throughout the film who's clearly, I don't know, at peace is not the phrase I would use with the violence in him, but he recognizes his violent nature, and it doesn't faze him as much when he just kills people very without ceremony, without thought or anything. But it, you know, he's lived in the bar long enough,
Jed, sorry to interrupt, but that scene at the bar, I think, perfectly reinforces your point, which are one of my favorite just shots, compositions in a movie of many years, and has stuck with me since the second I saw it, burned into my retinas, is Guy Pearce sitting at a bar looking disheveled and tired and like just only maintaining. It's like a fence post on a farm in the blistering hot Australian outback that for some reason the wood looks like it's rotting, but it will not fall down. That's what he looks like, sitting in that window, and a car tumbles past the window, like in the most frenzy of chaos, and he doesn't even look up from his water or whatever he's drinking. I think about him in that context. It's like, yeah, this violence is like a car driving past is just as much like a car driving past is as normal as a car tumbling down the road and smashing and glass fragmenting and people bouncing around inside it. That's just normal, par for the course, easy.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we don't know it, you know. I took a look just an hour or so ago, just kind of skimmed through a handful of reviews I found online, and nobody could agree on what, you know, everybody seemed to have a definite opinion, but nobody was really saying the same thing about what the nature of the collapse was, right?
Yes.
You know, it could have been, you know, looking at it could have been economic. It could have been climate.
Yes.
It could have been war, you know, and all three of those things point to different types of collapse. You know, economic is systems breaking down, and, you know, climate is that elemental thing, you know, the elements overwhelmed us finally. War is like a moral collapse, you know. Yeah. That something that devastates us because of you know, ultimately moral choices that we make and that we can't sustain. We can't sustain the weight of you know, the consequence of our of those kinds of choices, and I think that it really could be any of those things, and it really could be all of those things. And every time, you know, I think it's part of what is so beguiling about the film, and that every time I watch it, I'm thinking it's something else.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's this, I'm thinking of it as a, you know, oh, it's a tale about, you know, economics, or it's a tale about, you know, climate preservation. Yeah. Or it's a tale morality.
I don't want to put my finger on it. But the only thing that's recognizable to me is because I was lucky enough, like in my life, I've done some traveling. And one of the times that I did travel, I traveled over into Africa and I traveled into Zimbabwe. And when you went when you go to Zimbabwe. I'm not sure what it's like currently because the trip now is more than 10 years ago. But when I went there, you know, one of our guides was like, it's only American dollars. That's all people will accept at any store, anything like that. So you've got to have American dollars everywhere you go. And at the time, like some of the travelers that I was with were buying Zimbabwean hundreds and millions and thousands of dollar notes that were on the street because they were worth nothing. And then were playing cards with them, like Monopoly money. You know what I mean? Like they would buy them for like a couple of bucks, American dollars. And so that's the thing that was reminiscent most to me is like when Guy Pearce is everyone using American currency, but particularly in that first scene where he makes that really exceptionally violent choice with the little person sort of gun seller. And he's like, it's $300 American. As soon as he said that, I was like, oh, this has been some kind of like horrendous economic collapse. And what has happened to that is that, and then when you see sort of like militarized armed forces and stuff, it's like, what did that collapse then happen? You know, I feel like there's multiple things that could happen there. And what triggered the economic collapse? Was it climate? Who knows? But I just, that is one little remnant of like real life things that have happened in the world where like states fail and their currency fails and American dollars become the signifier that's a currency that actually means something in the world. And clearly Australian society is dead, you know, like it's gone. Like for whatever reason it is, all it signaled to me was like Australia is over. Like whatever concept of Australia, that Australia was, it's over.
Do you think of this, do you think of The Rover as a Western? Do you think of it as a post-apocalyptic film? And if so, what distinction would you make between those?
I think the only distinction that you make between a Western and a postal, because Western are morality plays, right? Like that's ultimately what a West, like as far as I'm concerned, every Western is a morality play. And what signifies that it's a Western is the time that it's set. Because largely every Western is talking about the time that is produced more than the time that it's actually set. And I think that Westerns and science fiction have that extremely in common, except one transposes itself to the past to tell the story about the present, and the other takes itself to the future to tell a story about the present. So for me, I see it as a post-apocalyptic just because of the setting. Like that's my thoughts of it. But is it a morality play? Yes. Is it set in the outback? Yes. Like if you said it was a neo-Western, I'd be like, yeah, I'm fine with that. Like I don't think the genre is dependent on that, but that's part of the reason why like I have equal love for science fiction and Westerns, because they both talk so much about the time that they are produced, about the values, about the society morals, about changing views of different things. They're interchangeable in that regard, except one of them plays in the olden days and one of them plays in the future. And that's, to me, that's like the gigantic distinction.
I think of the distinction usually being that Westerns, by and large, are about people realizing they're in a precious time of freedom and there's encroaching civilization coming and they're afraid of that.
That's great.
And post-apocalyptic ones are about, oh my God, we didn't realize how good we had it with civilization. Now that it's gone, I find the, you know, I would probably say The Rover is more post-apocalyptic in that way, except that the Guy Pearce character really wants nothing, no part of any society. Like usually in a post-apocalyptic film, you're finding these pockets of people who have just one thing that they've held on to from society.
Yes.
And that's it's become a very distorted version of what society used to be, but that, you know, they've really emphasized this one thing. And you do find that in here, you know, there's the merchants, the guys with the convenience store, you know, that's their one thing. They're not doing anything but sitting in a room with a bunch of tin cans, right? Like they're not working on anything.
No.
They're just sitting there trying to sell something. Or you got the doctor, the veterinarian, you know, who is, and she's not even concerned with money. You know, she's like, I've I've learned to get by without money. I'm not doing this for money. I'm, you know, this is, and you got the soldiers who are just keeping the peace, not because they believe in justice. You know, he says, I don't care what happens to when you get to Sydney, you can bribe them and you can do, you know, I don't, I'm just doing this job to remind them that we're still here.
Yes.
And that they'll keep paying, you know, that's the only reason I'm out doing this. And so, you know, these, all these people kind of going through these empty sort of pantomimes of what society used to be. But Guy Pearce doesn't seem interested in joining anything and building anything. You know, he's much more like a Western hero in that regard. I think that he's drifting. He's a rover, you know, he's one of the four possible interpretations of the title, right?
Yes.
I think, he's the ranger, the rover, you know, and he's not even Mad Max. Mad Max is driven by this maniacal need to survive. And he's not even driven by that.
No, and even Max's pantomime of justice, as you said, I love that word, pantomime of like justice and law, is like he's the last signifier of law in a lawless world, and he doesn't care about doing pantomiming law anymore. He just wants justice, like in that first Mad Max. It then drives him to just be a force for justice. Like, he can't help himself, even all the way to Fury Road when it's Tom Hardy, he can't help himself but have the impulse to justice. Like, he's like, I want to get out, I want to be by myself, but when I'm in these situations, I can't help myself but like try and not watch the scavenger horde or whoever it is like kill everyone. Like, he actually has some kind of care. He will eventually warm up to like, all right, the last thing I can do is help. Whereas Guy Pearce is like, he doesn't care about anyone. He wants that freaking car.
But I do think, I mean, so the other, I think Rob Pattinson is also the title character in The Rover, you know, in that he's kind of becomes like a loyal dog, right? And that relationship they have, you can see Guy Pearce looking at him more, you know, like every time he does something unexpected. And Ray really is of just, you know, confounding in his, yes, he seems mentally slow, he seems emotionally stunted, but he's also, the other film I think about a lot with, in comparison to The Rover, is The Proposition.
Yeah.
Where,
one of my favorite Guy movies Pearce of all time.
So Guy Pearce has got the Outback trilogy, right? Priscilla, Proposition, and The Rover.
Holy shit, we need a box set. We need a box set, the Outback, the unofficial Guy Pearce Outback trilogy. Yes.
But, you know, in The Proposition, you know, it's a Western. There's encroaching civilization coming, and it's going to stamp out Danny Houston's party, right?
Yes.
But it's also driving and stunting Ray Winstone, you know, existence, this need to dominate and tame. And, but, you know, in The Proposition, the only characters who are really alive are the psychopaths, you know,
yes.
Danny Houston's gang, as for all the absolutely the atrocities that they commit, you know, they're also the only people enjoying themselves.
And John Huston, you know, John Huston's enjoying... amazing role too. He's another psycho that just is on the road, and he's loving life. He's living it up.
So he's out there. You know, they've got poetry and singing and literature
and culture.
And, you know, that great line You know, is that what we are? Misanthropes? No, we're a family. You know, and they're just sort of out there maniacally dancing in the maelstrom, right? Like they recognize this world is utter chaos, and it's, you know, there's death coming from any number of ways, and one of them is me, and I'm but you know, I'm here to enjoy myself, and you know, so it's everybody else in the movie is so bound up with the one thing they have to do. You know, I've got to bring order. I've got to, you know, save my brother. I've got to, you know, whatever the thing is, it's, their world is reduced to that, and they're so stunted by it. Everything, they don't experience their life. You know, Danny Houston and his character, his gang are really the only ones having a full life. And I feel like Ray is that character here, that he is, yes, he experiences pain. He cries. He, you know, is angry at his brother, but he's also singing along to pop songs on the radio.
Yes.
And he's talking to strangers. He speaks, you know, I'm not sure what language it is, but he speaks, to the woman, asking her directions to, you know, what's the name of the town? It's not Cameroon. Anyway, the Kowloon, is it? Anyway, he asks her directions. Like, Guy Pearce can't communicate with her. He goes over and talks to her. He's got American dollars. He talks to, you know, he can make small talk with the guy at the, you know, all the characters in the Rover. Most of them have like one line of dialogue that they just say over and over and over again. You want to buy something, you got to buy something. Or where's the car?
I said it was $300. You know, said it was $300.
Robert Pattinson, he can talk about anything. He can even small talk. He can have memories he talks about. He can have, you know, he's like living the full sort of spectrum. Now it's a limited life, it's a diminished sort of, but he's the only character in there kind of experiencing the full spectrum of emotions, and you know, he's not completely burned out on everything. And so it's fun to watch Guy Pearce slowly kind of be amazed by him every turn. There's something else that this guy does that, you know, kind of quietly amazes him and endears him to him. And by the end, by the final reveal of who the titular character may be, you know, it kind of makes the relationship Guy Pearce was feeling toward Rob Pattinson more. You feel it deeper, like, oh, he really was sort of filling a hole in this guy's
his enthusiastic companion, because he can't feel anything, and despite, it's almost the amazement that you talk about, which is what I love in that increasing sort of empathy, because he doesn't seemingly care about anyone on this earth, but the flex of empathy and the flex of humanity come out of like the fact that he can still make small talk and still show slight rays of sunshine about good thoughts in the world when everything else has told them that no one actually cares. Soldiers don't care. They're just doing the bare minimum. Traders don't care about their products. It's like, buy it or don't, I don't care. Gun sellers, buy it or don't, I don't care. Like, it's like, as you said, everyone is like that. Buy it. I'm taking the car. I just want my car back. I'll follow you. No, you're not giving you your car back. It's just like, it's not, why do you want the car? It's like, just, you know, who cares? Whatever the case may be. It's like, nah. And I think that that's why they say, you know, that's what people talk about when you have a pet, about how like you can have a shitty day, and if you do have a pet dog, they're so thrilled to see you walk through the door every day, no matter how good or bad the day has been. And their excitement and feverishness, it's like an infectious thing. It's like, oh, hello. Yes. It's like having little kids. I'm sure you've got your boys with you right now, both of them older. Like, my kids and I play this game every day. It's a Bluey-based game, which is like we sit around the dinner table and ask, what's your favorite thing? And my answer is usually boring because it stays the same. What was your favorite thing today, Dad? Coming home and seeing you guys. Like, because they run to the door, Daddy. So no matter how good or bad the day's been, if it's a good day, it's even better. If it's a bad day, it's a life preserver. It's like that kind of, that can give you so much. And I think that that's what, in a strange way, that's what Ray does. Like Ray becomes that fleck of hope because Ray has been shot, abandoned. You know, he's slow. He gets abused. He's hyper emotional. And yet he's still got humanity and still wants to help and still wants justice and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, I think it's, I think you're spot on. It's really special, the relationship that they have. And I called it like there is a kind of Stockholm syndrome-ish relationship that they have. But nonetheless, it's kind of, I don't know if I wrote about that at the time and that's what I clocked it as in my first watch, but I wouldn't use those same words again. I would say that it's kind of like, it might start out as something like that, but in the end, I think there's more that Ray is doing to help maybe the title character of this movie, or I just call him the man with no name because I don't call him the Rover. But yeah, I don't know. It's a really fascinating movie.
Yeah. It's, again, I think of it a little bit differently every time I see it. I love their conversations about God too. The treatment of, you know, most of the times when you got a washed up, you know, kind of hollowed out person who believes in God the way Guy Pearce does in this film, it's usually coming from a great loss, right?
Yes.
I had a great loss and now God took that away from me and I can't deal with that now. You know, that's my idea of God, is he took away something beautiful. And Guy Pearce, his revelation about why he's so angry at God is because God won't punish me. God won't punish me for that awful things that I did, you know, and I can't, I haven't recovered from him not punishing me for killing my wife and this, you know, her lover. And that's a new one. That one hits me hard every time
because if God won't punish me, then he might not exist.
Yeah,
which is as elemental, yeah, as anything. It's like, especially, it's like, that's why these, you know, there's even a great, you know, Western series called Godless, you know, like it's about that whole thing of like, if with everything that I see, how can there be God here? Because it is a society defined by violence and defined by just immediate impulse. And a human obstacle is as immaterial as like chopping a branch on a path. Oh, it's overgrown, I'll just chop it. Like, it's like literally anything that is an impediment is gone. And humans are like that too. And so, yeah, that's a really fascinating thing that he's got. It's yeah, really incredible.
But I think about John Hurt and the proposition too, that line, you know, about, I used to be an educated man and I had God in me and I came to this place and the God in me just evaporated. You know, it's there's something about the outback, I guess, that this is, you know, when you use the word God forsaken.
Yes.
That's what it, but my God, it's a stunningly photographed film.
Oh, it's absolutely beautiful. It's gorgeous. The Australian outback is gorgeous. It will not be tamed in the traditional sense of being tamed because it's brutal. But like, and I think that that's like the emotional quandary that lies underneath, like from an Australian and First Nations perspective, when I look at this movie, that which is an undercurrent is like, the outback to us seemingly is always this untamable thing. You see it in like, Picnic and Hanging Rock and Walkabout. You see it all the way back from the Australian New Wave. It's like that there is something about the place that European colonizers will never understand, that a thriving culture for 60 to 150,000 years lived here and just worked with it, because the people here who are the custodians of the land respect the unexpected elemental things. It's like, it's too hot, so mm-hmm. we move. They don't build towns in places that have catastrophic floods every year. They don't build towns in places where they are like uninhabitable. They like go there, they tend to a plant, and they, you know, or go there because, you know, a certain breed of animal is going to be there, a certain fishing is on for a certain time. And then these nomadic people then just move. But like in the sense of the Australian outback, it's like, you know, in that very European way, it's like, I'm going to carve out this land and I'm going to make it farmland. And it's like, good luck. Like, good luck. It doesn't work like that here in some of the outback. But no, this was shot in South Australia. Bit of trivia for you guys, near a place called Mare. And it's stunning. The landscape is beautiful. There is something awe-inspiring just about the endlessness, the boundlessness of some of the plains. And it's incredible. And like the sun hitting the tarmac and the sunsets, it's like, there's nothing like those sunsets. There's nothing like those nights with the blankets of stars. Like it's incredible. I'm really glad. It's the most epic thing that Michaud has really shot, as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, when he made Animal Kingdom, as great as it is and as beautifully photographed as it is, it's all about intimacy and it's all about like penetrating people's mindsets, you know, and you know, the blurred lines between your sort of impression of a thing and the thing. Whereas The Rover is like, it's trying to have the scale, which is great, of obviously the beauty, but then these little, you know, rusted reminiscences of what society was. So David Michaud makes, early on, he's making some, you know, miniseries. He co-writes Spider, a terrific Nash Edgerton short film. I would strongly recommend you go and seek it out. It's hilarious. Made a couple of shorts, but then he comes in and he does Animal Kingdom in 2010, which has a massive international splash, blows up all around the world. Joel Edgerton, who was already kind of big, explodes. Ben Mendo Mendelsohn can say that that point in his career is the time that he went from a guy who had a tremendous amount of potential and had never had any of that realized on an international scale, is now a guy who's done a Star Wars movie, a Marvel movie, like, you know, has worked in some of the huge TV shows for Netflix. Like, he's had a massive career. Jackie Weaver gets an Academy Award nomination. Like, it explodes on, like, it goes off the charts. He then writes Hesher, which is directed by Spencer Susser, and that one stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Natalie Portman, which is like a kind of imaginary friend movie, sort of, if you like, but not that, because it's about a kid who's looking for, looking for a role model and finds it in like this dead shit rocker.
Heavy metal Mary Poppins.
Heavy metal Mary Poppins. 20 out of 10 for that
Pete's
description.
Pete's Dragon.
20 out of 10 for that description. He then makes The Rover in 2014, and we're like, okay, like, what's next? He writes the screenplay. He writes the screenplay and directs a Netflix comedy, like a sort of a massive satire called War Machine, starring Brad Pitt, which is silly, and I enjoyed that. Did you enjoy that?
You know, it's a movie that is less than the sum of its parts.
Yes, agree.
But there is a lot to enjoy in it. There's a lot of really fun performances.
Oh my word, there are some fun performances in it.
But nobody seems to be making the same movie, you know. yeah. Which I find point. Happens with Brad Pitt movies a lot, and sometimes that happens really well with Brad Pitt movies, but he's often you know, like the piece that doesn't fit into everybody else's movie they're performing in. But I will say, I have gotten over my initial sort of disappointment with it, and I've watched it a couple times extra, and I do, there's enough to it that I enjoy that I will come back and watch it more. But yeah, I don't think it really works as a, you know.
Yeah, no, it
I don't know that its goals were it, I don't think it's met its goals.
No, I think it was it's one of those things where Dave Michaud is funny and he does work really brilliantly with ensembles, but I just don't think that, you know, after, I don't know, some two things that were so deeply like quintessentially Australian, if you like, that went from like Animal Kingdom and the Rover, he then bounces into like an America. And it's like, I always think that some of those are better, the satires that cut deeper and they kind of work better when it's someone from within the culture telling the story about the culture. Like, I do think outsiders are fantastic sometimes to like cast an eye on it, but I would have thought, like, personally, I would have like, you know, you almost want a kind of Adam McKay at the time of The Big Short kind of treatment of that war machine thing for it to work. And it doesn't seem to have that. And then finally, like his most recent film that we already talked about it in part of this episode was The King. Again, another Netflix movie starring Tim Chalamet, starring Joel Edgerton, starring Robert Pattinson, having the most gleeful fun time. Sean Harris, Ben Mendelsohn is in there as well. I watched this at the time and I was like, yeah, it was totally fun and really good and interesting movie, and I had a really good time with it. But since then, David Michaud kind of disappeared, other than being an executive producer on the Animal Kingdom series, which went for like 75 episodes between 2016 and 22, which I've never wanted to watch. So yeah, I he's kind of like, it's been a really interesting kind of weird time. And it does say that he's got one sort of in the can, a new movie called Wizards. But that looks like a kind of noir comedy. That he co-wrote again with Joel Edgerton, but he's been out of action for such a long, long time.
Well, he and Nash Edgerton, you know, Nash did The Square. I mean, yes. The Square came out before Animal Kingdom, and The Square is what really got me looking into Animal Kingdom.
Yes.
The Square blew me away. And you know, all those Blue Tongue films came out.
I love Blue Tongue.
I
saw Spider first, because I got a YouTube clip of it and I was like, whoa. And then The Square, it did Blue Tongue. And then I was like, anything Blue Tongue does, I'm in. Like, literally anything, I'm in.
I really, really enjoyed most of their stuff. But you know, Mr. In Between is something else that goes in there, of course, David Michaud is an actor, a recurring role on that show. You know, and I talked a little bit with Jen Johans on her podcast, and we interviewed and you were part of that interview.
I was part of that
with Scott Ryan, where we talked about the propensity on that show for just casting directors as actors and having having Scott Ryan just abuse them and dominate them and humiliate them was a really fun recurring thing on that show. But yeah, I would like to see Michaud return to, I mean, I'm a crime guy. I want to see him get, I want to see everybody get back to crime stuff. Ultimately, you know, I think that those are my favorite. Those are, you know, morality and philosophical films, crime films. You know, they recognize the hypocrisy and the, you know, the established order, and they're about people finding their own morality, their own codes of ethics and things like that. So that those are endlessly, you know, the possibilities for crime, I think, are pretty limitless. And you get to look pretty badass sometimes in a crime film, which
you get to look, you get is, to look
is,
awesome.
Is a bonus.
Yeah.
You get to look. So, you know, I'd like to see him get back and do more of that. But yeah. And Nash Edgerton too. I mean, he directed every episode of Mystery in Between. So that's great. But you know, Gringo was okay. It was not great. It was No, the Square. I just watched The Square again the other day. Actually, The Square and The Rover reminded me of each other in the way that they're both these very, they end with these sort of very bleak jokes.
Yes.
Like the whole movie has been a setup for this punchline, and you go, oh, God.
And it's not a joke that's funny. It's a joke that hurts your soul. And you're like, ow, right. Ow. No. Yeah.
So, you know, I love that sensibility that they both have. I would like to see both of them just keep doing more of that. And, you know, Joel Edgerton has done, I think he's had a pretty interesting career.
Did you see Master Gardener? I mean, look, Joel's a fascinating
character. Oh, yeah.
You know, Joel is, I would like to see Joel come back. I know that he's lent his name weight to so many things to get started in Australia. So as an Aussie, to see so many independent things get graced by his name or the Blue Tongue label or like executive produced by, just to push something into production, I have to say that he's like done fantastic work there, and I would love to see them do more. The big thing that I think with Joel is one of the most charming fuckers you'll ever meet in your life. Mm-hmm. I've been lucky enough to meet him a couple of times, and in his Australian accent, he's so charming and so wonderful. And I do think that he does good accent work, you know, doing different films around the place, but I like to see him in more Aussie stuff. And I would love to see, I would love to see him in more Aussie stuff where he could be a leading man. And I just feel like right now the currency conversion rate, the tax breaks of different international productions, I'd like to see, you know, much in the same way that I was so thrilled to see Eric Banner doing The Dry, you know.
Yeah.
I would love to see Joel take, you know, some big Australian author's work and, you know, get him down here to make some more genre films, because like I saw him in The Master Gardener this year, which I very recently, as you guys are listening to this in 2024, I watched it in 23. I love The Master Gardener. I thought that was excellent. He was excellent in it. You know, again, a Paul Schrader, God's Lonely Man movie, Card Counter, you know, First Reformed, Master Gardener, gimme. I'm in. And, but he was excellent, and he's excellent. And he, you know, I think that Joel, like, sometimes does things that are great and then other things that are sort of iffy, but he's had such an amazing career, has had so many huge movies that are fantastic and others that are just okay. But that's not a reflection on him. It's usually the movie. So yeah, I'd love to see him come back and do more Aussie stuff, because I think that, you know, he's got a real relentless charm. And as he's getting older, it's like it's like time for an Aussie Sam Spade, like get a little bit older, a little bit more beat up, mm-hmm. you know, like that kind of, I want to see some crime stuff from him again here. And I don't need him to be the complete dirtbag. I think, like, also let's make him a leading man. Can we make him a leading man as well?
Yeah. He seems like, frankly, he seems like tailor made to be a movie star, you know.
Yeah.
He's good looking and a good actor, and, you know, hugely, I would think he's hugely appealing to women, and he's hugely appealing to men. And
I can unequivocally say he's a writer, is hugely appealing. Director. He's hugely appealing to men. And my wife was with me when we met Joel Edgerton, and I can say he's hugely appealing to women. I can say from the perspective of my wife, she's like, oh my word. I was like, yep. Okay. I gotcha. I hear you.
Yeah.
I hear Jed, this has been unreal talking to you. Thank you, mate, for helping me kick off this now ongoing series on One Heat Minute, looking back a decade. I hope more people, if you haven't ever seen this, I don't think we spoiled too much. I hope you get a chance to check it out. I'd love to hear what you think. Jump on the Discord, jump on Twitter. Let us know what you think of this one if you haven't seen it. I really enjoy it. I have a lot of time for it. So, and I love talking to you about crime movies, and this is an Aussie crime. So you are technically, I think, as a person who's watched every Australian film, I think you're technically an honorary Australian. You're the only other person I know who's watched more Australian films than like even Australian film psychos. So yeah, you're an honorary Australian. So bless you.
You know the Guy Pearce, Joel Edgerton movie that made me think, oh, they, you know, Aussie's really got it going on with crime is The Hard Word.
The Hard Word.
I saw that one theatrically.
Oh my
God. Back when, you know, I didn't have, all the cares in the world that I do now. But, you know, I that's one I still come back to. And I'm like, God, lightning. I mean, the cast and talent involved in that, I'd like just let's keep making more movies like that. So
2002, that movie came out. Rachel Griffiths is in it too. Scott Roberts directed. Yes, Hard Word is very good. And I don't think that he made really much of anything else as a director after that. So
he has my permission. he can do again.
He's got my permission and endorsement. Well, we're not going back to 2002. We are back in 2014. That's why we talk the Rover. Jed, you're awesome. Thank you so much. I know you've got some stuff that you've been working on. Is any of it pluggable in 2024 right now?
Nah, nothing is pluggable. No
pluggable. I got nothing.
I have nothing. You know what? You can buy my book in France, or you don't have to buy it in France. You can buy it wherever you are, but you can buy it in French. But yeah, I'm not in English anywhere.
What's the translation of Fierce Bitches in French?
In French, it's like the ferocious or something. And
Le ferocious.
Peckerwood's the affreux, the ugly, or something like that. So, you can buy those books in French.
If you want to do a Duolingo or whatever one of those language apps are and you want to learn how to speak French to read Jed's great books, I'm lucky enough to have the monographed. So I've got a little nice little piece of writing in mind. So yeah, you can't borrow it. It's too sacred. You're the best. Thank you, mate, for doing this. And there's definitely other 2014 movies you want to talk about. So we'll find something else to talk about in this series.
Yeah. Maybe some Aussie.
Maybe some Aussie movies. Ooh, exciting. Let's do that.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.